Luke, the Gospel of Luke, chapter 16, verse 9, when he says, I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, money, that when it fails, when you lose your job, and in our case, when we die, they may receive you into an everlasting home. Now, Jesus is not saying you're supposed to build some kind of financial favoritism so that you can earn your way into heaven. That's not the point. But what he is saying is he is saying use your temporary management stewardship role so as to provide benefits in eternity. Or as we put it last week, invest your failing wealth in unfailing ways. Your time on earth is limited. You're managing someone else's wealth, God's wealth. So manage God's wealth in a way that benefits you forever, not just immediately. Now, what does this look like, and where do you start in living this way? And this is where Jesus, and this is where we pick up from last week, in verses 10 through 12, lays out three proverbial comparisons. He compares little to much, fake to real, another's to your own. These three comparisons. And he helps us understand the story he just told by giving clear statements as to what it means. Now, are we together on the importance of story and statement? Jesus tells a lot of stories, and Jesus makes a lot of assertions, statements. And some of us are story people, others of us are statement people. Is that not true? I mean, some of you, when you came in, it's like a movie in church? Come on. What are we doing? Like, we don't need more stories. We don't need to hear stories. We need preaching. Like hellfire, direct, declarative preaching. Is that true? Yeah. We do. Did Jesus tell stories or did he make statements? Yeah, both. Why? Because both are important. What happens with a story? And I'm talking good stories. A lot of trashy stories today, but good stories. What do stories do? Stories amplify statements. They amplify in the sense that they go out and they address more than just one sense. You know, when you see a story, even a mundane story like what we just watched, it addresses more than just your mind. It forces you to feel and think and choose, you know, what was going on there and how you feel about what was going on. So you enter into the story and it amplifies truths. That's the positive about story. Story amplifies statement. The negative is that without statements, propositions, assertions, declarative statements, without statements, stories can be made to mean whatever you want them to mean, right? I mean, you could take a story like that and go away and justify dishonesty and say, Jesus teaches us to be dishonest or to wheel and deal or to look out for your own interests even if it hurts someone else. Because the story is amplifying, but it's not always clear. That's why we have to understand stories amplify assertions, but assertions, propositions, statements clarify stories. Does that make sense? Statements clarify stories. So Jesus does both. He uses stories because he wants to address all of us in the sense of all of me. He doesn't want to just address my mind. The goal of coming to church, the goal of studying his word, isn't just so we can walk out and say, I learned something new. As important as that is, that's just a small part of what Jesus wants to do this morning or at any time. He wants to address the whole person. And that's why he tells stories. But he doesn't just leave it at stories, because he's not just interested with you walking out feeling something. He has something specific to say to you. So he combines story and statement. And there's parts of the Bible that are more story, and there's other parts that are more statement. And the whole put together is vital for discipleship. And that's why we preach through books like Romans, that is far more what than yeah, it's far more declarative, far more statements, propositions. But then there's other historical passages, whether the parables or the Old Testament narratives, that are far more story. We need a balanced diet. So all of us are being addressed, our whole being, but we really understand what he's saying. So today we're going to focus, now that we've looked at the story last week and then caught it, another visual modern version of it this morning, let's look at some declarative statements in verses 10 through 12 and seek to understand, what does a faithful manager who is investing his failing wealth in unfailing ways do? And he gives us these three comparisons. First one, the comparison and the progression really from little to much. Little to much. Faithfulness with much follows faithfulness with little. Look at verse 10. He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much. And he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. And one of the things I hate that I do too often is when I'm driving down the road or I'm just kind of vegging, my mind wanders, you know, into things like, what would it be like to win the lottery without buying a ticket? You know? And I don't mean just a little one, but I mean big. And I start, you know, this is weird, but I start dreaming of having these huge foundations, you know, where we could, for example, fund adoptions. You know, there are orphans both in our country and all over the world where there are Christian families that could take them in, but it costs so much money, and young couples coming to us and saying, hey, I want to adopt, and we could say, hey, we can write the check. Wouldn't that be cool? Or ministry training. You get a young man who's called to be a pastor and wants to get trained, and we can just say, hey, quit your job. You come here. You serve here. We will fund the whole thing. We'll send you out to plant a church. Or missionaries saying, I want to go to the mission field, and we can just say, hey, we can cover the whole cost. Wouldn't that be cool? And every time my mind starts wandering into one of these things, which I guess there's a part of that that can be sinful, and there's a part of that's good to have a big vision, but God always brings me back to the same place. What are you doing with what you have? Because some of us can spend a lot of time daydreaming about what we would like to do with what we want to have. And Jesus is saying in verse 10, hey, what are you doing with the 10 bucks in your wallet? What are you doing with the money I have already committed into your care? Kids, this is important. You're 8 years old or whatever. And one day you're thinking, I want to do great things for God. What are you doing right now with the money God has entrusted into your care, and the time, and the opportunities, the resources? Jesus says, if you want to know what you would do with much, look at what you do with little. And I would suspect, and I may be off here, but if I believe I can say that most of us don't believe that. Like in the core of our being, we really think, no, no, no. If I had that much, I would do something big for God. We really don't believe what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying, no, you want to know whether you would really do something big? Look at what you do with little. We look at people like Hudson Taylor, for example, great missionary, over 100 years ago, and we look at the way God uses some of these great missionaries, and we think, well, I could never be like that. But we forget what they do with the little. We just see what they did with the much. Hudson Taylor began China Inland Mission. He began dressing as native Chinese dressed, and he went into areas that missionaries had never been in. And even today, you know, over 100 years later, there are millions of Chinese people coming to know Christ. I mean, just continually. The church is growing exponentially, not just because of Hudson Taylor, but because of Hudson Taylor and hundreds and hundreds of other missionaries who planted seeds and made investments, and God took that and caused it to go much further than anyone could have imagined. Literally millions of dollars went through his hands in today's currency. Millions of dollars went through his hands as he funded so many different ministries and missionaries. You think, well, that would be cool, you know, to be used in such a great way. But if you step back and look at his early Christian walk, I want to share a little excerpt out of a missionary leadership evaluation booklet that Alan Shearer is putting together, and it talks about how Hudson Taylor, when he was a young man and knew God was calling him, moved from a very comfortable situation. He wasn't married at the time, and moved into a one-bedroom, little tiny place, and started to devote more and more time to studying the Word, ministering the gospel, feeding the poor. And this is what he said. He wrote about that time, brought into contact in this way with many who were in distress. This is before he's on the mission field or anything. I soon saw the privilege of still further economizing and found it possible to give away much more than I had at first intended. Having now the twofold object in view of accustoming myself to endure hardness and of economizing in order more largely to assist those amongst whom I spent a good deal of time laboring in the gospel. In other words, he was seeing both the benefit of disciplining himself now. This is before he's on the mission field, in learning how to say no to himself, and also benefiting those around him in his current opportunities, not waiting. See, some of us live under the delusion that when we buy a plane ticket, and if God were to call us overseas, we would suddenly become a spiritual giant. Is that true? No. If you can't love Jesus in America, you can't love Jesus anywhere else. So, start with the little. Listen to what he said. I soon found out that I could live upon very much less than I had previously thought possible. Butter, milk, and other luxuries, ouch, I ceased to use, and found that by living mainly on oatmeal and rice with occasional variations, a very small sum was sufficient for my needs. My experience was that the less I spent on myself and the more I gave others, the fuller of happiness and blessing did my soul become. Now, don't misunderstand my point. I don't want anybody going away thinking that oatmeal and rice is the new hallelujah diet, you know. That if you're not just eating this, then you're not spiritual. That's not the point. A tailor knew how to both be abased and to abound, just like Paul said, because that stuff wasn't the main issue. It was whatever it takes to be prepared to serve the Lord. In whatever situation he's called us to. And God calls different ones of us to different situations, and that's a beautiful thing. But the point is that we can't miss is if we won't start with the little, we're never going to experience the big. And many of us are enamored with the big, but we're not faithful with the little. Secondly, Jesus says, he moves us from the fake to the real. Trust with real wealth flows from careful use of passing wealth. And he makes this point in verse 11. Therefore, If you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? Do you see the contrast between the unrighteous money and the real thing? It doesn't seem like it's parallel, but I think the best way to understand this, I think, is like a basketball game, for example. If you're the coach of a big college team and you've made it to the Final Four and you're in the big game and you're down by just 1 point and it's in the third quarter and your key player gets injured and you look at your bench and you've got to decide who to put in, and are you going to look to the player who practices without any discipline? Like, he's sloppy in practice. He's always messing around, joking around. Or are you going to look to the player who practices consistently? In other words, in the scrimmage, when it's not a real game, when it's not the big moment in the big game, he comes through every time. That's the player you're going to look to, right? And what Jesus is basically saying with this comparison between unrighteous and real, true, he is saying, in a very real way, the money that we've been given today is like a scrimmage, a dress rehearsal, practice. He's running drills, okay? And he's giving you resources, and he's saying, okay, work it, go, push it, push it, push it. Like a coach saying, I've given you resources, now go. And what are we doing with it? Because some of us, we've divorced what we do with money from our relationship with God. And it's like we're living two different lives. And we can waste money and not think a thing about it because we think, that's just like what Jesus says here. That's just unrighteous mammon. Doesn't matter. No, but Jesus' point there by calling it unrighteous is not... Do you remember last week when we talked about the Platonic dualism? You know, form is spiritual, it's good up here, according to Plato, and matter is chaotic and it's bad. Jesus is not saying that. I know he uses the word unrighteous to describe money, but you can tune me out if you're not into the philosophy thing, but for Plato, that structure of form and matter was cosmological. In other words, it described the structure of the universe. That is not the case with Jesus. He is not a cosmological dualist saying that the structure of the universe is form and matter, form being intellectual and good, matter, what you see and feel, is bad and chaotic. That is not what Jesus is saying. If the closest thing to dualism you can get with Jesus is you have this age and the age to come. It's really not dualism. And Jesus is saying the true wealth is from the age to come. It's the kingdom of Christ invading this age. Let your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. You follow that? And what Jesus is saying is when you use money today as if there is no tomorrow, no eternity, that's unrighteous. It's not honest. It's not looking at life properly. You're living as though the only life is what you get now. It's your best life now. And Jesus says, no. It's not your best life now. It's your best life later, according to Jesus. But because of later, because of the best life is later, that's going to invade today and cause you to use what he's given you today wisely in light of tomorrow. Does that make sense? I know that's a mouthful. But because of that, Jesus says, the conclusion some of us might come to is, well, if the real game is tomorrow, it really doesn't matter what I do today. And Jesus comes to the opposite conclusion. He says, the tomorrow makes today significant. It's important. What you do with the fake is significant. your monopoly money, if you will, is significant because of eternity. If you wipe out eternity, it really doesn't matter because nothing matters. You're just born, you're going to die, eat, drink, and be merry. But there really is no purpose. Jesus says there is a purpose. And so, because of this, these true riches, I mean, God, in a sense, you could ask the question this way, what if money is a funnel through which Jesus pours real wealth? What do you mean by that? I mean, like, some of you have a lot of money. What if he gave you that money because he really wants to give you true riches? You say, well, how do I think about that? Well, first of all, it's going to give you humility and it's going to give you warning, right? Because Jesus said that it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for an American to go to heaven. Right? I mean, we could come up with all these cool illustrations about what he really means by camel is this gate in Jerusalem and all this other wacko stuff. No, Jesus' point is you can't get a camel through the eye of a needle without a miracle. I mean, I overheard my wife talking to the kids about that verse this week, and she was saying, well, you'd have to take the camel and put it in a blender one piece at a time and then get it through there. And that's really what God does, isn't it? That's what Jesus says, you got to die to live. And when you feel like God's taking you apart piece by piece and he's kind of squishing you through something, it's like, oh, this is killing me. That's what he's doing you. He wants to save an American. And that's the only way he can do it. If we think we're going to get through with all our garbage, we've got a sobering thing coming to us. So he's blessed us. Why? Well, it's not so we can think we're the greatest or, you know, we're somebody or we need to pamper ourselves. He does so because he wants to funnel blessings on us. This is a drill. This is a practice. This is a scrimmage. This is a dress rehearsal. So what is he wanting to pour on you? Not just money, but real riches. He wants to produce humility and grace and generosity and all these beautiful joy. But that won't happen if you think the money is the real thing and the true wealth is not really important. What about if you're on the other side? Like, you may be tested right now with prosperity. That's a tough test. Actually, more people go to hell because of failing that test than poverty. Prosperity is the harder test because its tentacles wrap around us and suck the life out of our souls. But there is another test, and that is poverty. And God still wants to use that test to pour, funnel beautiful gifts on us. And some of you are in the middle of that right now, where you feel like you cannot make ends meet. And God is wanting to produce true riches in you, true wealth in you, joy and peace and satisfaction. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. I mean, he wants to pour those blessings. Go for the real wealth, is what Jesus is saying. Don't be satisfied with the fake. Whether you have a lot or you're just jealous of people who have a lot, go for the real thing. Let him funnel that wealth and use this opportunity as a scrimmage so when the big game comes, you're ready to play because you understand what is really important. Third comparison. He's compared the little to the much, the fake to the real, and the third one is the another's to ours. Look what he says in verse 12. If you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? You could say it this way. Permanent ownership is an end result of faithful stewardship. Now, what does he mean by this? This is confusing to us because we're not that familiar with the manager mentality, right? Go back to the parable. I mean, Jasper. didn't own the farm. He was given the responsibility to manage the farm. And what Jesus is saying is, you don't own your stuff. I mean, in a second, it's taken out of your hands. It's not really yours. You're a manager for a temporary time. So use it, spend it, invest it, share it in a wise way, so when it fails, when it's gone, you have something. So how do you do that? How do you move from managing to owning? Most of us think, if I want to move from managing somebody else's resources to owning, I need to grasp. In other words, our natural response is to cling to it, right? If we could just get it in a foundation and write a good enough will, well, no, I'm not going to be here. If I could just, we try to cling to it. But what Jesus is saying, there's another way to do it. Consider Matthew 6, 19 and 20, where he says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth." And see, some of us think Jesus is saying, don't lay up for yourselves treasures. Don't you hate it when we talk about finances, and most of us think what Jesus wants to do is to strip us of all money and fun. He wants us to be poor and miserable. And Jesus said, no. Look at that. I'm not saying don't lay up for yourselves treasures. I, as a matter of fact, I want you to have treasure. I want you to be filthy rich. Don't pull that part out of the sermon and think you're in a health, wealth church. But what he is saying is, do not lay up for yourselves treasures where? On earth. Why? Because Jesus wants you to be miserable. No. Because if you lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, you're not going to really own them. You're just going to borrow them. They're just going to be yours temporarily. Well, what's going to happen to them? Well, moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, and markets collapse. Can't imagine that, but hypothetically, the stock market could go down, and things like that can happen, and you can lose them. So what's a better plan? Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, because heaven is moth-free, Eternal mothballs protect your assets. Rust-free and thief-free? Yeah. No one's going to steal. There's never a downturn in the market. They're guaranteed. And guaranteed by a better source than the government. I love that one. Our government is going to guarantee this. And you're thinking, is that supposed to help me feel better? You're the guys that got us in this mess, and now you're guaranteed. That's good. Whew, I feel so much better. What he's saying is, if your treasure is invested in an eternal account, it's going to end up being yours. Isn't that weird? I mean, you're really going to own it. You're not just going to borrow it. You're going to have it. That's why he says, don't lay it up in a temporary place. Lay it up in a permanent place. And people, this is why Christians can be happy and joyful and even talk about things like helping others in a difficult time. And this is why people who have so much are often so miserable even in a good time, because they think they own it, and yet they realize the older they get, they can't really keep it. Let me throw out a few examples why rich people are often so miserable. Here's a few examples of those who were. Rockefeller said, "I have made many millions, and they have brought me no happiness." Vanderbilt, "The care of 200 million is enough to kill anyone. There is no pleasure in it." John Jacob Astor, who was the first multimillionaire in America, in colonial America. He started buying up New York when it was the Little Apple and then sold it off. And they say when he died, he was worth what would be today $115 billion. He said, "I am the most miserable man on earth." Henry Ford said, "I was happier when doing a mechanic's job." Andrew Carnegie said, "Millionaires seldom smile." Once Randy Alcorn was taking a test to try to figure out a person's lifespan. You want to know how old you're going to live? And it had all these different factors that came in. You know, do you smoke? Do you drink excessively? All these things that would lower your lifespan. One of them was this. Subtract 2 years from your life if your family income is over $50,000. Alcorn was kind of struck by that. Why would that be? And he said, materialism is the mother of anxiety. The more you have, the more you worry about trying to keep what you have, the lower your lifespan will be. Because we know deep down, even if whether you're an atheist or you're a Christian, you know you really don't own it. You're just borrowing it. And stocks plunge, homes mold, and bodies die. So invest your failing wealth in unfailing ways. Now, some people, many of us, what keeps us from doing this is we have somehow bought the myth, and this is a myth, pure myth, there's no truth to it, that you can be too heavenly minded to be of any earthly good. You hear people say things like this. Do you know anybody that's that way? I don't know anybody. I mean, maybe you've read about it, but I don't know anybody that's literally too heavenly minded. If you're heavenly minded, you're going to be really earthly good. You're going to do a lot of earthly good. The people that say they're too heavenly minded are actually other things. But they're not heavenly minded. Because the fact is that the people who are most heavenly minded are most earthly good. Do most earthly good. C.S. Lewis, the Oxford professor, said this: if you read history, you will find out that the Christians who did most for the present world were just those who thought most of the next. The apostles themselves, who set on foot the conversion of the Roman Empire, the great men who built up the Middle Ages, the English evangelicals who abolished the slave trade, all left their mark on earth precisely because their minds were occupied with heaven. It is since Christians have largely ceased to think of the other world that they have become so ineffective in this. Alcorn says, every time you give to world missions and famine relief and God's kingdom, you can dream about the day you will meet these precious people in heaven. One day, money will be useless. While it's still useful, Christians with foresight will use it for eternal good. So where do you start? Let me just suggest a couple things, and this is not comprehensive in any way. I just want to get your mind thinking on a practical level here. How do you live this out? ABC, first of all, acknowledge that everything you have is from God. Have you done that? Are you doing that? If you're like me, you can't just do it once. I mean, we've gone through our whole house, committed it to God. You know, I constantly think, God, do you want me to sell this thing? I mean, it's the nicest thing I have. Do you want me to get rid of it and have to just give it back to God and say, if you want me to, it's yours. Everything I have is yours. And it's so freeing to know we can give it away, we can use it, whatever. It's not ours. You got to do it continually. And it frees you from anxiety, and it puts you in a posture of generosity. So first of all, acknowledge it. And notice it doesn't say make everything God's. It's already his. Just stop the delusion that it's yours. So acknowledge it. Secondly, budget. Don't you love that word? Budget wisely and eternally. And I know some of you, when you hear the word budget, these envelopes, you know, just start racing across your mind and you're like, oh no! you know, or you try a new program, because some of us are convinced if we can just get the right computer program, we can be a good budgeter. And so you've tried like 10 different computer programs and somehow none of them work right. Now, I don't know what you're going to use, but the bottom line is, if I'm going to stand before God as a manager and I don't know where my money's going, that would concern me, right? Most of us, many of us, the only thing we know about our finances is we just don't have enough. That's not stewardship. That's not wise. So if you need help with this area, we do have financial counselors, and we have a new class starting in a couple weeks in Life Ed. It's going to be a help class, not just somebody preaching at you, but helping you set up a budget and develop these simple principles. They're not that complicated. They're not easy, but they will help you. So budget wisely, but also eternally. Don't just stop. What Jesus is saying is don't just stop with, okay, how much we need for food, for car, for, you know, retirement, for, no, don't stop at retirement. That's way too short-sighted. Move on into eternity. That's when budgeting gets fun. And then back up and say, okay, how can we get from here to there by starting today and starting to adjust our priorities, starting to, in the little areas, one step at a time. The third one is cut the debt. And I know this shouldn't deserve its own point, but the only reason I mention it as a part of these three simple things is because that's what's killing many of us, right? It's really hard to get excited about helping little girls in Cairo when we're building high-rises through Citibank, when most of our money is going to pay interest and we're paying 2 to 3 times for things that we've bought because we always want them before we save for them. I want to challenge, because we got a lot of young people in here this morning, and I want to lay out a challenge to you. And I'm not saying you have to live this way if you're a Christian, but I just want to commend it. 20 years ago when my wife and I got married, I don't know where this came from, but somehow we came to the conviction that we were never going to borrow for a depreciating item. And I'm not holding us up, please, please, because we've done a lot of dumb things and continue to. But to never borrow for a depreciating item. In other words, you're never going to have a furniture payment. You're never going to have a credit card payment. You're never going to have a car payment. You're never going to borrow for anything depreciating. You may owe on a house for a while, and you aim to knock that out. And I would challenge some of you teenagers, before you do the American thing and build up a good credit. That's what we often define it as. You know, I want to get in debt so I can have credit. And even if you go to some financial counselors, they'll tell you, you know, debt is good because then you can have credit. But what that assumes is it assumes that the economy is never going to change. And as soon as it goes down, what happens? I mean, everybody's in trouble. What if we had a sea of Christians at North Hills Community Church who are living in their means and don't owe? So when the economy goes down, we're like, yeah, we can help people. We can minister. We can go to the mission. We can go wherever God calls us because we're not lugging around this huge weight of debt. Because the borrower is servant to the lender. Can you imagine? And I'm talking to everybody, but primarily young people who haven't started the debt cycle. If you lock in on that commitment, you may not be able to drive a new car. You may not have all the furniture your parents have in the first year of marriage. Oh, horrors. But you can be free. And you say, is that Jesus' goal? No, that's not Jesus' goal. He wants to take you way beyond that, where it gets really fun. But if we don't start there, passages like this are just laborious. I mean, it's so discouraging. when you read Jesus' words and then you think, I can't even think about that because, A, I don't know how much is coming in and where it's going, and it's going somewhere to people that have loaned me this money because I couldn't say no to the latest impulse. It's Christmas soon. Commit not to buy Christmas gifts on your plastic. No amen on that one. And you may have to, like, make paper airplanes for your family members and paint them, you know, and say, sorry, it's tight this year, but we're going to start saving in January for the next year. We'll try to make it up for you. But this year, we can't do it. I mean, whatever you got to do, some of you just need to stop the cycle today. And if we can help you with that, we want to. Because it is, this can be fun. I mean, Jesus is, he's drilling us. He's given us an opportunity to scrimmage here with plastic and paper for the real thing. Not because he wants us miserable, but because he wants us to be free and full of joy. Lord, we thank you for what you're teaching us, and we pray that as a church we would not take these words as words of guilt or discouragement, but we would receive these as words of life, because Jesus, you who had everything, gave up everything, that we who have nothing can have everything. So give us eyes to see, Lord. Please set people free. Raise up a generation of young people who refuse to believe the lie that they have to have everything today, but are living for eternity and are faithful stewards of what we've been given. Lord, please help us. And Lord, for those who don't know you and don't know how much you love them, may they see your cross, the ultimate expression of self-sacrifice. May they put their trust in you. And so, Lord, give them ears to hear, so when they hear your teaching, they will not be threatened by it, but they will feast on it. What a life of joy it is to follow you. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen.